Thank you very much, Dr. Ben, who's a new friend of mine, and it's a great honor for me to speak in chapel. As he said, I spent 34 years in Christian higher education. Maybe even more significant than that was that time at Cedarville as an undergrad, just like you are now. I loved absolutely every minute of my Christian education. I met Sarah there the first week. I looked across the bonfire, and there she was giving a testimony. I was never the same since. And, you know, we met our freshman year and started dating our sophomore year and broke up our junior year and got engaged our senior year, which is, you know, pretty typical pattern. You know, the university, when I was involved, the young ladies would sometimes come to me and say, these guys around here, they're just like, they're so poor, they're so bad, they won't ask us out. You know, they're not. I said, look, you know, and the freshmen, when they show up, I don't know if that happens at Union, they show up, maybe five or six of them walking around as a group. Did they do that, guys? Five or six ladies walking around as a group. Ladies, think about this. No guy who's 18 years old, or 60 for that matter, has the confidence to walk up to five women and ask one of them out. I mean, you can't do that if you expect to be. Look, go to the library, look nice, look lonely, it'll happen, okay? Just trust the Lord, it'll happen. And by the time you're seniors, you're walking around two by two like Noah's Ark, you know? And that's Christian college. And I loved every minute of it. So I hope you love every minute of your. I mean, I gotta tell you one more story. When the ladies would come see me sometimes when they had troubles, they would tear up. And, you know, it's not a sign of weakness or anything. They're just wired differently, but they'd often would tear up. Now, the guys, when they would come to me, the guys would look at their shoes. And for a while, I thought, what is that? I couldn't figure that out, and it dawned on me. Ladies, you've got like 50 pairs of shoes, right? Guys have two pairs of shoes. Maybe three, right, guys? I mean, three. We have a relationship with our shoes. And when we get in trouble, we look at our shoes and we receive solace and peace from that. I mean, that's how guys work. Ladies are wired differently. Well, I represent something called SAT-7, which stands for satellite. And I'm really not here primarily to talk about SAT-7, although I will a little bit. It's a family of Christian satellite television channels, based in the Middle East. It was started in 1995. Went on the air in 1996, now 20 years of age. It's the first Christian satellite ministry based in the Middle East. I work on the U.S. side of that and raise funds and do all those kind of things, but go back and forth for about three or four times a year in the Middle East. And our people there, it's indigenous. 80% of what we put on the air is produced by Middle Easterners for Middle Easterners. So it's not guys like me being dubbed Westerners or whatever. It's Middle Easterners. And it's a quite influential ministry, and we'll show you a little bit more about it. I'm mainly here, though, to talk about Middle Easterners, or what you sometimes, you know, kind of synonymously think of as Muslims. And that's not too far off. It's about 98% Muslim in the Middle East. But I want to talk a little bit about how we reach and approach Middle Easterners in terms of the gospel. Because things are happening today that you don't get on CNN, you don't get on Fox. And I want to start with a bit of a thesis statement, kind of in an academic environment. I can't prove this. I can't prove it. But I happen to believe that the single greatest challenge facing the early 21st century church, the body of Christ, capital C, that's us, okay, is learning how to witness and minister to Muslims abroad and increasingly at home. Now, we have experts among us, maybe here at the university, probably here at the university, and there are experts nationally, but most of us sitting in the pew, most believers in the United States, we don't have a clue. And we have a lot of kind of ideas and influences and attitudes and feelings that are quite human and understandable given our experience with the Middle East and North Africa in the last 10 years or 15 years. But at the same time, we're still commanded to go out and share the gospel, are we not, and to reach them. So I look at the Middle East, North Africa, and as Dr. Ben said, there's like 22 countries that are Arabic speaking. There is Iran right here that is Farsi or Persian language. That means the same thing, spills over into Afghanistan. And then there's Turkey, the Turkish language. And I'll show you a slide in a minute of the language kind of distribution. But it's a region of the world in which there's 525 or so million people. It's growing about a million a month. I've slowed a little bit, about a million a month, though. So the birth rate is far greater than what we'd have in the West, and certainly greater than what's going on in Europe, which is upside down backwards. They're not even having babies anymore over there, it seems like. And it's growing, and people are concerned about that. What's that mean? They're concerned about the number of Muslims and specifically Middle Easterners that are leaving the Middle East when they can. They're becoming immigrants, the refugee crisis being part of that, and going into Europe. They stay there until they get what they call the golden passport to the United States, to Canada, to New Zealand, maybe to Australia. If they don't get that, they stay there. They have to. And it's becoming, again, kind of a crisis humanitarian in a number of ways. There's been 3,100 Middle Easterners who died at sea this year, fleeing mostly the situation in Syria, secondarily in Iraq, some in other parts in Africa, but mostly they're Syrian and Iraqi. Maybe 800,000 refugees going into the Europe this year. So you look at this region. It's a region, as I said, of 525 million people. We've got maybe, what, 335, 340, so it gives you some feel by comparison. It's a region where there's 1% of the world's Bibles, 1%. Less than 0.1% of missions giving ends up in the Middle East. So I kind of sometimes say we're losing by default. One of the reasons people say that there's only 0.1% of missions giving from the West that actually makes an impact in the Middle East is that they don't want us there. These are closed countries. Well, socially, religiously closed, yes, many of them. But think about this. From the perspective of a sovereign God, there's no such thing as a closed country. There's no such thing as a closed heart, for that matter, from the perspective of a sovereign God. And in all of those countries, by the way, whether Sat7 or other ministries like it existed or not, there are believers. There are Moroccan believers. There are Egyptian believers. There are Yemeni believers, okay? There are certainly Lebanese believers, all of this throughout this area. And the church in the Middle East, you could say, is suppressed. In some places, it's oppressed. In some places, periodically, it is persecuted. You've heard of churches burning in, of all places, Alexandria, Egypt. Not in, you know, Saudi Arabia. They don't have churches in those places. But nevertheless, it's that kind of an area. It's a region of 50%, and this varies by country, of 50% illiteracy rates. It means they can't read a Bible even if you gave them one. Can't read the front page of their own newspaper. Can't fill out a job application. They're functionally illiterate. I mean, they're dumb, okay? They may be running successful businesses or doing all kinds of things in their lives, but they can't read. They haven't had the privilege of education to learn how to read and write like you and I have when we were little Epers way back when. They haven't had that. So it's a region where television, back to satellite TV, is an enormously powerful medium to connect with people who cannot otherwise read. And all these things I'm saying, ladies, it's worse. The statistics are worse. Higher illiteracy rates among women, higher in certainly rural areas. In the Muslim culture, now when I say this, I'm always careful about this. Not every Muslim, okay, man or husband, beats his wife. And on the flip side, tragically, there are Christian men who beat their wives. Okay, so we got to be careful about this. You know, all those bad Muslims are doing this and the rest of us are, no, no. But there is, within the culture of Islam, an attitude toward women that clearly places them on a second, third, fourth, fifth level, almost like chattel, almost sometimes like property. Even in a little more open or a little more enlightened country, if I can use that word, like Lebanon, a woman cannot go, well-educated, has a job, Christian maybe, cannot go to the airport with her passport, buy a ticket, and fly out of the country without a letter of permission from her husband. That's just their law, just how they live. And you say, well, that's not the worst abuse in the world. No, that's not, but there's a lot of other uglier things taking place, and women are always getting the brunt of that. No question that women are the more vulnerable. Sometimes we say that wherever men are vulnerable, and they're vulnerable throughout the Middle East and North Africa, wherever men are vulnerable, women and children are more vulnerable. And again, ladies, it's not because you're weak. It's just because how things are structured in the world in which we live. Because usually where there are ladies, there are children, and there are greater responsibilities, and a lesser ability to move or to get out or to make connections or do all the things that they can need to do to protect themselves. So you have all this kind of thing taking place in this part of the world. Of course, we have Syria that's upside down in a civil war, 250,000 people killed in the last few years, Syrians leaving there. You have little Lebanon down here. This is Lebanon right north of Palestine, as we call it, Israel. Lebanon is about the size of the state of Connecticut. It's about the same size as the state of Connecticut. There are 4 million Lebanese. According to the UN now, there's 1.2 million refugees. So one out of every five, roughly, in Lebanon now is a refugee. And I've been in some of those camps. You go up over the mountain, Mount Lebanon, up over the mountain behind Beirut and down into what's called the Baca Valley. It's kind of like the San Joaquin out in California. It's a breadbasket. It's where they grow everything. You go into that, and there are all these tent cities, and there are all these people. I've been in some of those tents and sat with these Syrian men who've literally walked over another set of mountains to get where they are. Why'd they do that? Are they cowards? No. They love their families. You know? What is an immigrant, by the way? We're all this, you know, talk among, I won't get political here with presidential politics in the United States, but all this talk about immigrants in the United States, and that's, of course, focusing on a different group. But what is an immigrant? I would submit to you that an immigrant is just a person looking for a better life. Okay? I mean, I know there are bad guys among immigrants. There's bad guys among everything. Okay? But immigrants are just people looking for a better life. I mean, we are a nation of immigrants. I mean, we get kind of juiced by the Oregon Trail story. But let me tell you, you talk to any Iranian first generation who's in this country, they have their own Oregon Trail story. Through Canada and swimming rivers and into Turkey and all kind of stuff to get here. I mean, it's amazing what they've had to go through just to survive, okay, let alone thrive. So I don't have, frankly, a bad attitude about immigrants. Again, there are bad guys, I know that, and TSA is necessary, I know that, and so forth. But you look at this, this is an area that's just an absolute turmoil. So here's Lebanon, 1 out of 5, 1.2. Turkey up here, a nation of 78 million, has 2 million immigrants or refugees. So twice as many as Lebanon, but a country that's considerably larger. By the way, Iran here, you think, well, how big is that? No, it's like, you know, Texas plus West Virginia. Okay, give you some feel for the size of these countries that we're talking about. Israel, by the way, is about the size of the state of New Jersey. So it's not hard to get from one place to another pretty quickly over there. Which is why, by the way, Sat-7 is based in Cyprus right there, the little island. Cyprus, if you read about Cyprus on Wikipedia, it's like they don't have their own history. What they have is the history of every empire you've ever heard of. Because every empire that happened grabbed Cyprus immediately because it was so strategic. Especially back in the days of the wooden ships when they needed to drop off and shoot a deer or, you know, just take a break or get some fruit or whatever they did. It's still strategic today in airplane times because it's an hour and 20 minutes from Cairo and 45 minutes from Beirut and, you know, it's that kind of thing. So Sat-7's been based there for 20 years and it's been a good place to be based. Now, recently they've had bank problems like the Greeks, but it's a good place. So you look at this, it's an area of unprecedented crisis and instability. We got this thing going on. I'll show you real quickly the languages. Those are where the Arabic language, sometimes they ask us, well, why doesn't Sat-7 go down into Africa? Well, we program in Arabic, Farsi, and Turkish, and there are not a lot of Arabic speakers down into Central Africa and down further. So we program in that area. We program for Farsi or Persian, means same thing. Iran plus Afghanistan here, Dari language is similar, and then the Turkish languages. Those are the three dominant languages of the Middle East. And by the way, I should mention this on the last slide. These countries here, Morocco, Algeria, the largest country physically now in Africa since Sudan split up. And by the way, the country that the church is probably growing faster in Algeria than any other Arab country of the world today. These countries are really different. If I said to you, hey, France and Germany are different, French and German are different, well, duh. Yeah, I mean, we know that, right? Speak different language. They look, sound a little different, you know, different architecture, different food. Hey, these countries are all Arabic speaking of a sort, but they're very different, very competitive, culturally different. I mean, Americans and Canadians are different. Do you know that? I mean, we go out and about, they go oot and a boot. I mean, there's a lot of differences, right, in what we do. We're different from Jamaica. We're different from England, even though we speak the same language. We're culturally different. So these countries are more different than you think. And so on the news, you know, Wolf Blitzer gets on there, and not that he's doing anything wrong, but he, you know, the Middle East. It's like saying Hispanic. What in the world does that mean? You know, you lump everybody in there that speaks a little Spanish, but they're very different culturally, different countries from which they come. And same is here. They're very different, and then the rest of the Middle East is different too. I might add one more thing before going on. Iran here is a nation of about 75 million people. It is 65% under the age of 35. 65% of the country is under the age of 35. It's almost backwards of what the United States is today. Now, what's that mean? You're not old enough to remember, but in 1979, a guy named Ayatollah Khomeini came in from France, landed, and the Islamic Revolution took place. Khomeini ousted the Shah of Iran, 1979, ousted believers and a bunch of other, and then he took over, and now it's Khomeini is the supreme mullah, supreme leader, Khomeini. But at any rate, potato, they're safe. But at any rate, there they are, they took over. That's 36 years ago. So 65% of the population can't remember the Shah. That's the point. The real point is 65% of the population have never known anything about religion except used as a tool to power. But that's their image of religion. Graft, greed, corruption used as a tool to power. So there is a hopelessness at work throughout the Middle East, but also in Iran. There is an openness in the people of the young people of Iran like never before. They don't hate the West. The young people want the same thing you do. They want to go to McDonald's. They want to wear blue jeans. They want to date who they want to date, marry who they want to marry. You know, have a good job, raise their kids. You know, they want freedom. That's what they want. That's mostly what the Arab world wants, except some leaders and extremists. But we get such a dose every night of the extreme part, which exists. There are bad guys. But we think that all of them think the same way. No. Remember that Islam and Muslim are two different things. Islam is a religious system, a theology, political principles, a political ideology with which I disagree. Muslims are just people. They're just people. Most of them are cultural Muslims, in the United States too. Most of them have read less of the Quran than I have, and I'm no expert. Okay? Quran's hard to read. Okay? You can get it in English, you know that. It's not official, but you can get it in English. It's official, it's in Arabic. But nevertheless, when you look at that, and I talk to cabbies, by the way, all the time. Didn't used to, but I talk to cabbies because they're all from over there. I'm in Manhattan, I'm riding along, and I say, hey, you don't mind me asking, where are you from?
Algeria.
Okay, great. How long you been here? 6 years. What are you doing? Oh, I'm studying computer science. You know, he looks like he's about 28 or 30, you know, about my kid's age. And I say, got a girlfriend? You know, guys love that. No, can't afford them. I say, well, you know, I understand that. And then he said, you got family? Well, I got family back there. You like it? You glad you came here? Yes. And then about 10 questions deep, you know, driving around Manhattan, you say, hey, you don't mind me asking, are you Muslim? Oh, yes. You go to the mosque? Nah, no. I mean, I get that answer every time. No, don't go. Don't go. I'm Muslim. That's an identifier, but I don't go. Well, that's not so different than a lot of cultural Christians. Are you Christian? Oh, yeah. When's the last time you've been to church? I don't know, Easter in 1910. So you have this sort of kind of thing going on. But there is an openness that, and what's growing, by the way, in Iran, I mean, in reaction to this hopelessness and in reaction to seeing religion as a tool to power, three things are growing. What pastors, when I was a kid, used to call worldliness, hedonism, promiscuity, drug and alcohol abuse. And again, ladies, the women, man, they're getting caught in that, and they're worse off in all of that. So there's that. The educated women, by the way, there's more educated women in Iran than the other countries because the Shah gave them access to education but not to power. So there's a lot of well-educated women running house churches in Iran. This is kind of interesting, secret churches. So what else is growing? Zoroastrianism, which is an old Persian religion, kind of mystical, that your theology profs can tell you more about than I can, but it's theirs. They're proud of it. You know, they're proud to be Persian. They're into that. And the other thing is the church. Christianity is growing in Iran. Missiologists are telling us this. They said this at the Lausanne Congress a couple years ago, that Iran, the church is growing faster in Iran than probably any other nation of the world today, even faster than China. Percentage-wise, which is, you know, fascinating. So it's almost like the more the mullahs act like mullahs, the more the church grows, because they see the contrast. Okay, well we got to move a little bit beyond this. Speaking of contrast, this is about different perspectives. Some of you are seeing faces, some of you are seeing a vase, some of you are seeing both. I just do this to say, look, you get all this stuff on the news. You hear, you know, Fox or CNN or whatever your favorite news channel, and you get this sort of image and attitude and ideas about Middle Easterners, or maybe you have a few Middle Easterners who live in your area from where you're from, and you have a certain feeling and attitude. I won't explore those here. But I always like to go back to Jonah. Remember him? Love that story. Loved it when I was a kid, still do. Here's Jonah. Remember the story. So easy, only four chapters. God says, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. Well, Jonah's first mistake is he had bad feelings in his heart about the Ninevites. He didn't tell God about it. His second mistake is he took off running from God. You know, try that. That works. But he took off running, right? And he books a passage on a ship. He gets out on the Mediterranean. You know the story. God sends a big storm. The guys are petrified. They're losing their lives. They're going through. They're calling out to their gods. Jonah has a fit of conscience, and he finally says, guys, it's me. It's me. Throw me overboard, and you'll be okay. Well, the guys were happy to oblige, and away he went overboard, and Jonah drowned. That was the end of the story. No. God sent this big fish. He sent a big whale or something, right? Swallowed him. I don't know if Jonah knew where he was or not. He must have been icky, but he was alive, and he was praying for 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the whale. And then God speaks in his mercy to the whale, And the whale kind of burps up Jonah out in the middle of the Mediterranean, and Jonah drowns at that point. No, no. God told the fish to go all the way back to, interestingly, near Nineveh. Okay? Burped him up on dry land or close to it. And Jonah praises God and then takes a shower, and then he heads to Nineveh. And he proclaims God's glory, and the Ninevites, you know, they respond, and a tremendous revival takes place, as we call it today. And then Jonah does what every preacher does when he preaches. He gets ticked off that people responded positively. No, what does that mean? You know, what kind of guy is this? Okay? He even has the temerity to say, God, I knew you would do this. You know, just kill me. Take me. Oh, God could have obliged. He didn't. But he has another object lesson about the vine. I won't get into all that. You remember that. Here's Jonah. Jonah never wanted to go. In modern terms, we would say Jonah was biased toward Ninevites. He was discriminatory. He was prejudiced. Maybe he certainly had fear. Maybe he was even racist in his attitude toward Ninevites. He thought the world would be better if we just nuke them. Just get rid of the Ninevites, Lord, and we'll all be better off. I find it ironic, but it's very human, that Jonah wanted to do to Nineveh and get rid of the Ninevites for doing what he wanted to do to them, what he thought they did to his people. You know, he thought they had mistreated his people, or he knew that they had. So he turns around, just wants to nuke them, get rid of them. Hey, there's a lot of those feelings and attitudes about Muslims in the United States among Christians. And that's the whole point of bringing this up. Because the last chapter, the last verse, the last sentence of the book of Jonah, God says this, rhetorical question. God's talking to Jonah. Should I not be concerned about that great city? Jonah, should I not be concerned about that great city? Should we not be concerned about this great region? Whatever our feelings, humanly understood, whatever our kind of fears and concerns, are our bad guys in the world. But they're still human beings. You know what? ISIS, when you get down to it, every one of those people, they're just human beings made in the image of God. Wow, that's hard to take. It's like our grandparents' generation. It was hard to take for them, believers, to think, you know, Nazis, Hitler, even, a human being made in the image of God, all twisted up, dominated by sin and vice, evil, couldn't be stopped other than by force, but they're just human beings. And one of the reasons they got that far is that the church and the gospel, and you know, we missed the opportunity. And one of the things in the providence of God that's taking place today is that all across the Arab world, there are Arabs, especially young ones, who are asking the question, why, what does this mean with ISIS that Muslims are killing Muslims in the name of our common God? What kind of religion is that? And there's more openness. In Iraq today, there was a survey done recently that 32% of the respondents said they were atheists. Now, that would be a startling statistic if you did it in a Scandinavian country, that high. But in Iraq, it's just mind-boggling. And I don't think they're saying that I hate God, I don't believe in God. I think they're saying that we just don't, you know, we're so disillusioned with religion that we're going to the only known alternative, I'm an atheist. But I also think that means they're open. They're open to reaching. That's why I want to go here real quick. There are Muslim movements to Christ. There was a scholar, I'll give you his name in a second, who recently did, he interviewed all kinds of people. He defined the Muslim movement to Christ by 1,000 baptized believers. That's not really a lot. He did all this work from when Islam got started, found one Muslim movement to Christ in the 7th through the 10th century, none for the next, two the next, two, 11 in the 20th century. Wow, that's really cool. 21st century, 13 years since he published a book a couple years ago, 69 movements. You say, well, that's still not very many. No, but it's hugely significant in the sense that you can document that the Spirit of God, that's what he means by a wind, here's his name, Dr. David Garrison, Wind in the House of Islam. What he's saying is that the Spirit of God is moving through this thing called Islam out there, the houses of Islam, Dar es Salaam as they call it, and God is at work like never before. He is at work. And I can tell you stories, I don't have time, of the contacts we get from people. And why is it happening? Prayer movements that are focusing on the 1040 window, focusing on the Middle East. Traditional and non-traditional missions. Among non-traditional missions would be things like Sat-7, satellite television, Christian television, that can get into places you and I couldn't safely go. That can get directly to people in the safety of their own homes. You know, you can't jam satellite TV. You can't effectively do it. And once you get it, you don't have to pay a monthly fee like we do over there in the Middle East. It's free to air. So you get 600 Arabic channels, you know, and among them Sat-7 channels, Sat-7 Kids, and so on. So, you know, we hear from people in southern Saudi Arabia that we would never have any ability to contact in any other way. And then, of course, visions and dreams I won't get off on all that. That book's a great book, Tom Doyle's book, of how God's using visions and dreams. And I come from a theological tradition where we didn't do a lot of visions and dreams, and frankly, we're a little suspect of it. But I'm not going to throw a rock at you if you said you have a significant dream or vision. But I think God's using that methodology, if we can call it that, in that part of the world, because they don't have a church on every corner like we do. They don't have a Lifeway store or a Zondervan store or a Christian bookstore everywhere. They can't get on Amazon.com and order anything they want. They can't get Chuck Swindoll 24 hours a day on radio. I mean, you know, they just can't, they can't do all that. So he's speaking to them in different ways, and he's drawing them to himself. And this is really the point. Middle Easterners, they're not as resistant to the gospel as you might think. In fact, mostly they haven't heard. And it's easier to talk to a Muslim here in the United States, your neighbor, about the gospel than it is to talk to your atheist neighbor. Atheist says he doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in eternal judgment, doesn't believe in right and wrong, doesn't believe in things like, doesn't believe in a holy book, a sacred book. Now, it's hard to live your life like that, but that's what they say. A Muslim believes in all that. They believe in one God. They believe in a holy, sacred book. They believe in Jesus as a prophet. Okay? They even believe in the virgin birth. The main thing that they have trouble with in Christian theology is the Trinity. You know, they what is the Trinity? I kind of joke, well, the rest of us kind of can't figure that out either. But nevertheless, you know, we have faith, we believe. But they're there, they're open, and they're open to talking about religion. And the way that you talk to Muslims about Jesus is the same way you talk to anybody about Jesus. You talk about your own testimony. You don't have to be an expert in Islamic theology and philosophy. You just have to be an expert in your faith. You know, it's what your age group calls authenticity. Just be authentic. Just be real. What's Jesus done? What's God done in your life? Why are you a Christian? Why do you have faith? Why are you still a Christian? Why do you still have faith? That's what, they're just people. So if you remember nothing else from today, remember that Muslims and Islam are two different things. You want to say something negative, talk about Islam. Critique that. But Muslims, remember, they're just people. Well, thank you. And get out of here and seize the day. And I hope you love every minute of your union experience. We'll see you.